Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi. As always, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week on NPR's Arts Channel, 3D dance movies, a new revolution in dance on screen, or just a flashy gimmick? We visit the International Cabaret Conference at Yale University, and a pair of interviews with two pop musicians from the frozen north, Sweden's Robin and Iceland's Björk, or rather, Björk. But first,
it's August, and that means another batch of new movies are heading to the theaters begging for your hard-earned dollars. But believe it or not, Hollywood is thinking less and less about your dollars and more about someone else's euros and yuan. These days, half or more of a movie's profits come from overseas. In fact, a bomb here in the United States can be a blockbuster abroad. Case in point, this summer's film, The Prince of Persia. Budget? $200 million, and here in the U.S., it only made about $90 million. A flop, right? Wrong. Overseas, it racked up an additional $237 million, and that got us wondering what, and more specifically, what actors have bankable global appeal? And to answer that question, we called on James Ulmer. He created something called the Ulmer Scale. It ranks over 1,000 actors worldwide, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
First off, how does the Ulmer Scale work? What exactly are you measuring, and how do you determine this ranking?
Well, if you think of the Ulmer scale as a kind of a stock market index for the stars, we look at how a star's power, in other words, how able is their name alone to sell a movie and get those bums into the seat, both nationally and worldwide. That's what we measure, and we use really the people who are at the power brokers, the people who are at the intersection of the deal point, the buyers, the sellers worldwide. These are the people that know Bruce Willis's value in Japan versus, you know, Germany or versus America, and who really, really control how well a movie does overseas.
Now, I've got the list right here in front of me, the Ulmer Scale's actors hot list for 2009-2010. At the top of the list, Will Smith. Why does he top the list?
Will is somebody who is almost indestructible in terms of his ability to choose excellent roles for himself. He's put himself in franchise movies, movies that are, you'd have legs, we call it. Maybe they're in one or two or three versions of them, and they're often action adventures, which always do well overseas. He's also somebody who is really smart and savvy and really orchestrates his career very carefully. He studies a box office, and he just doesn't blindly obey the advice of his manager and agents. He'll really take an active role in his own career choices.
As I look at the list, I'm just going to tick through the top 10 names. Will Smith, Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Tom Hanks, George Clooney, Will Ferrell, Nicolas Cage, Reese Witherspoon, Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Cruise. Not a lot of women in that list.
No. Unfortunately, I like to say that the global international marketplace is pretty sexist when it comes to their movie stars because, first of all, they can't lead the marquee. Oftentimes, even today, if you have a Julia Roberts who used to be able to sell a movie based on her name alone, today you'll need a male star. So they're also bankable, as we call it, really mostly in ensembles. They'll also be a little more sensitive to the market fluctuations out there. It's just a sad fact of the international entertainment marketplace.
What are the biggest markets overseas, and what kinds of movies sell well there?
Well, let's just take one of the biggest markets. Traditionally, has been Japan, and you almost have to ask what kind of movies don't sell too well, because generally, Japan, although you can't make absolute rules, they don't want to touch romantic comedies and some dramas, but they certainly do love the Twilight series. Scandinavia will censor a lot of violence, so Quentin Tarantino films don't do well there. Latin America loves genre movies, horror movies. And I think what you're seeing is that the foreign market, Michelle, is really going, responding to the idea of genre movies. And it's becoming a lot more tuned in to what's successful here in America.
James Ulmer, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
James Ulmer is the creator of the Ulmer Scale. It ranks actors worldwide based on their bankability.
The filmmakers behind the movie La Misión hope that Latinos will begin to talk more openly about homosexuality. The film takes place in San Francisco's Mission District, a neighborhood that's portrayed in the film as a community peppered with as much violence and macho posturing as culture and pride. Marcos Najera of member station KJZZ talked with the brothers behind the movie.
Peter and Benjamin Bratt grew up in the Mission District. The two brothers say their Peruvian mom was a neighborhood activist who raised them to tackle tough issues. And that's exactly what they're trying to do with La Misión. Peter wrote and directed the film.
This, in very many senses, is a coming-of-age story, not so much for the son as it is for the father.
Peter's brother, Benjamin, plays the main character, Che Rivera. He's a tough ex-con who learns his only son is gay.
But if you think that they're talking about it or processing it or however you want to call it is going to somehow make it all right or acceptable, or that maybe one day I'm going to, like, give you my blessing, then you're wasting your time. Because that's never going to happen.
Meaning?
Meaning I don't want to know about it. I don't want to have it anywhere near me. ¿Me entiendes?
We all knew getting involved with this that the story necessarily would explore heavy themes.
Benjamin says his macho dad character in the film feels hurt and betrayed by his son's secret. So the punches fly.
And then, of course, with his father, who is rigid, immovable, impervious to change, closed-minded, we really need to go in a different direction that doesn't involve violence.
Coming out stories aren't new, but they're rarely told from a Latino perspective. Even so, Peter Brett says his screenplay was a tough sell.
When we actually first took the script around and tried to get financing within traditional channels, even meeting with white gay executives, we're told, "Didn't you see Brokeback Mountain?"
The assumption among most studio execs, says Brett, was that a mainstream blockbuster had already dealt with a dangerous gay storyline. So Latinos didn't need a rerun. Peter Bratt disagreed.
I mean, Latinos and African Americans turned out in record number to vote for Obama. A few months later, they turned out in record numbers again to vote in support of the ban on gay marriage. And I think people realize, wow, this is still a huge issue within the Latino and other minority communities. And so what we hope is that it kind of shines a light and begins a conversation.
The brothers Bratt are determined to get their indie film into more theaters. So they're forging ahead with a grueling grassroots publicity campaign fueled by Facebook. If fans can secure a sellout at their local box office, then Benjamin and Peter might show up, either in person or through a Skype chat session.
I thought it was awesome, probably one of the best movies I've seen so far.
18-year-old Brandon Rios came to a screening in L.A. just so he could meet the movie stars. But he admits the actual movie threw him off guard.
Gay scene, I guess. I just, like, kind of kept my head down. Like, I was just, wow, dude, I didn't really want to watch it or whatever, but...
Do you mind if I ask you why you think you feel that way?
It just had me uncomfortable, you know?
This discomfort is familiar to the students that Salvador Pacach works with. He's a group leader for gay youth at East LA's Latino Community Center, Bienestar.
A lot of parents have a dream of you, of who you are, and we basically shattered that dream.
Who here wants a Spanish song? Who here wants a Spanish song?
According to Pacach, most of the gay Latino students he works with have parents who've abused them, either verbally or physically, sometimes both. So the clinic is a place where the kids can come to talk openly about their sexuality.
Many of these topics that we speak here at Bienestar are basically like taboos with parents. I mean, many youth cannot freely talk about with parents. I mean, some can, many can't.
The Bratt brothers hope their film can help change this family dynamic. Actor Benjamin Bratt says that's the mission of La Misión.
You know, what the film really is trying to do is examine how we as a society define power and how we define what masculinity is. And I think we sort of need a new definition.
The film opened to limited release this spring in New York and Los Angeles. It heads to more theaters across the country this summer. For NPR News, I'm Marcos Najera.
Dance could be entering a whole new dimension on screen. The Third Dimension, a movie released this weekend, Step Up 3D, is one such experiment, and NPR's Elizabeth Blair has been asking if this will be the next big thing in dance.
As a story, Step Up 3D is pretty lame, but the dance is pretty astounding. The plot, if you can call it that, centers around a big hip-hop breakdance competition. In one face-off, a crew dances in about an inch of water. Limbs are popping and locking, bodies are falling and rolling, and the splashing water just adds to the intensity. You do feel like you're there. I thought I was going to get wet.
It's not just a gimmick. If you use 3D right, there's a residue that is emotional about it.
John Chu directed Step Up 3D. Chu has been dancing and making movies since he was a kid. He directed the first Step Up movie, which was a surprise hit for Disney a few years ago. But he'd never done 3D before.
As much as research I did and how many lectures I went to, you really don't know 3D until you're in front of it and playing with it.
Now, Step Up is not a movie about ballet or even modern dance. It's hip-hop, and in that world, the faster, the better. But that was a problem for filming in 3D.
And so when I tell them, like, can you guys slow down a bit? Because when it goes too fast, my eyes can't keep up with it in 3D. They didn't understand that. So I was like, well, everyone put on 3D glasses. This is what we did in a test. And I said, okay, just freestyle to the music, and I'm going to turn around the monitor. So I turned the monitor around so they could see themselves in 3D. And within 10 minutes of them just playing around, they understood it right away.
I can't weigh up whether 3D is just a craze or whether it really is going to change culture.
Sarah Crompton is arts editor-in-chief and dance critic for the Daily Telegraph in the UK. The big dance movie in theaters across Europe right now is called Street Dance 3D.
Well, I thought it was enormous fun. I thought it had great energy, and arguably, I think the 3D-ness of it increases that energy because you do have a sense that this is vigorous activity unfolding before your eyes. So I enjoyed it, but I thought actually what it suffered from is what most dance films, whether in 3D or not, suffer from, which is a complete lack of plot.
In other words, it's a lot like Step Up 3D. Now, breakdancers aren't the only ones trying to add dimension to their films. Director Wim Wenders is working on a 3D movie about the late choreographer Pina Bausch. And the English National Ballet is working on a film that will air on a 3D TV channel that launches in the UK in the fall. Sarah Crompton saw 5 minutes of it, a performance of Swan Lake.
You had these vistas of dancers where you had swans coming towards you, if you like, and legs coming towards you and arms coming towards you. And when the corps de ballet ran off, they run towards you. You know, it's pretty good. You do feel that you're there, and it's quite exciting.
But Sarah Crompton is pretty sure these 3D dance films are nothing more than intriguing experiments, and that great dancers and great choreography is good in any format. She does think it'll make filmmakers better at capturing the beauty of movement itself. Step Up 3D director John Chu agrees.
Every rule that they say about 3D, we threw out the window with dance because it's just about motion. It's just about weight. It's just about creating poetry with your body. And the 3D gets you to be there with them.
Just don't go expecting much of a story. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
The word cabaret evokes so many images, singers dressed to the nines in elegant nightclubs or dark, intimate rooms, cover charges and two-drink minimums. What it doesn't evoke is college dormitories, dining halls, and 9 a.m. classes. But for the past 8 summers, aspiring singers have gone to New Haven, Connecticut, to attend a sort of cabaret boot camp, the International Cabaret Conference at Yale. Jeff London decided to check it out.
Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
For the past 30 years, Irv Rabel has come to the cabaret almost every night. He's been a club owner in New York, he coaches singers, and he's artistic director of the Cabaret Conference. Rabel says cabaret may be a rarefied medium, but it can also be deeply emotional.
The intimacy of it, I think, is the most important part. The fact that unlike any other genre in the entertainment world, You actually go into a room where you go out of there feeling like you know the person, you know something about them, they have touched your heart.
Learning how to effectively touch the heart may be the central goal of the 9-day conference, but the 38 students also take classes in repertoire, hair, makeup, clothing, sound, lighting, and marketing. Their ages range from 16 to 66, and they come from all over the United States and around the globe. On a drizzly July afternoon in the dorm's basement, Irv Rabel introduces the faculty and students to one another.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone. We're here from all over, as far away as Australia and Israel this year.
One of the Australians is a tiny dynamo with a big voice named Nikki Aitken.
My training has been in classical, jazz, and musical theatre. And cabarets just kind of seem to be the obvious choice to be able to take all the different kinds of repertoire and put it into one show.
That evening, in the first rehearsal, Nikki struts her stuff.
Something has got to start, I'm ready to be loved.
And all across the Yale campus, singers are hunkered down with some of the best musical directors in the business to prepare for their first presentations to the faculty, which includes Laurel Massey, an original member of Manhattan Transfer, and Tony Award-winning actress Faith Prince. The next morning, student Harold Sanditon performs his unique take on a Beatles song. Faith Prince likes it, but sees room for improvement.
Work it out and get it straight.
I need you to not close your eyes. I feel like you're closing your eyes on the most important contact.
Okay.
And you've done your homework. Your homework is done. I don't want to see that. Okay. I just want you to do it simply. You know exactly what you're doing. Start again.
Think of what you're saying.
At age 55, Harold Sanditon has traveled a long way, literally and figuratively, to come to Yale.
I was an investment banker, and then I became a theater producer for 20 years in London, and I gave that up 3 years ago to start singing, which is what I wanted to do in the very first place, but I never had the confidence.
Canadian Lindsay Sutherland Bowl has come a long way, too. She trained in opera, but changed her mind right in the middle of an audition.
I stopped singing in the middle of the aria, and I said, I'm very sorry. I don't want to sing Pamina. I don't want to sing Mozart. I don't want to sing opera. As a matter of fact, I never want to sing another operatic note for the rest of my life. And I walked out of that audition, and I walked out of my operatic career and into my career as a cabaret singer.
How can he ignore my pain condition?
Over the course of a week of 14-hour days, the teachers work hard to rid Bowl of some of her operatic habits, a tendency to use broad acting gestures. Today, music director Alex Rybeck is her coach.
I don't think it needs a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Simplicity. You're a very rich cake. Your cake does not require a lot of icing.
Okay.
Your face is very expressive. Your voice is very expressive. And the more stuff you do, the less we get you. It becomes a mask.
These
are just simple questions.
How could he ignore me?
Yeah.
How could he ignore my feeble condition?
Legitimate question.
Why these Victorian views?
Across campus, Nikki Aitken's preparing for the final concert, singing a tune Barbara Streisand made famous.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter.
She says she's learned a lot about focus over the past week.
Finding specificity and finding truth and finding ways to make it about the audience.
But Harold Sanditon says it's not just about digging deeper into ballads.
Probably the best thing I've learned is that songs that you think are really serious, you can find comedy in them, you can turn them. You can make something that nobody has ever sung as anything but a serious ballad, you can make it into a comic tour de force.
Me and Mr. Mrs. Jones. Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones.
On the last night of the conference, all the students have 3 minutes to show what they've learned in front of a paying audience. The concert is called Cabaret Stars of Tomorrow. Lindsay Sutherland Bowl performs in a striking red bustier, but with a newfound stillness.
I'm a stranger here myself. How
can he ignore my available condition? Why these Victorian views?
And Nicky Aitken focuses and just hits it out of the park. Afterwards, teacher Faith Prince is verklempt.
I think I've learned tenfold, a hundredfold, millionfold, even more than these students have. It's rocked my world, this conference. So I think they did incredibly, deliciously wonderful.
And who knows? Maybe some of them will be cabaret stars of tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New Haven.
You can hear complete performances for the Cabaret Conference at our website, npr.org.
She's a platinum blonde Swedish phenom who back in the 90s hit the U.S. Billboard chart when she was just a teenager with her singles Do You Know What It Takes and Show Me Love. I'm talking about Robin.
Always been told that I've got too much pride. Too independent to have you by my side.
Since then, she's mainly stayed under the mainstream music radar in the U.S., but she's remained popular in Europe. And if this punky pop super Swede has her way, that's about to change.
I've got some news for you. Fembots have feelings too. You split my heart in two. Now what you gonna do?
That's the song Fembot, taken from Robin's new album, Body Talk, Part 1. Body Talk Part 2 is coming out soon, and Part 3 will be released by the end of the year. And Robin joins me from our studios at the New York Bureau. It is such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You were just in D.C.
Yes, I was there a couple of days ago.
So 3 albums in a year is ambitious by any stretch. What do you get out of releasing 3 albums so close together and not putting all the tracks on one album?
I think for me it's been a really selfish decision. It's been about trying to find a way where I could have more fun making this record. And I started writing it in July last year. And I was just looking at, you know, the scenario of being in the studio for another year and then maybe touring for 3 years and not getting to make another album until maybe 4 years later. And it just felt too long for me. I wanted to get back on tour earlier. It's not a conceptual album at all, even though you might think that because of the 3 parts it is. It's really just a practical solution to that problem. And maybe it became a concept because it gave me a way of working that really affected the whole creative process as well. But it hasn't been a plan. It's just been something I've kind of figured out as I went along.
I have to say, one of my favorite songs on this album sounds a bit autobiographical. And I don't know, it just really caught me. I defy anyone to listen to your stuff and not dance to it. So this is called Don't Fill in the Blank Here. Tell Me What to Do, being a family radio show. I really like it. Let's listen to a bit of this song.
My smoking is killing me. My diet's killing me. My heels are killing me. My shopping's killing me. My ego is killing me. Can't sleep, it's killing me. My label's killing me. Kick drum.
Now, Robin, I just want to say, if I could, on this very day, I would put this in my car, roll down the windows, and blare it all over Washington.
Good. That's nice.
Tell me a little bit about writing this song.
I came off of tour, and I was just tired of having people in my face and not feeling like I had time to finish anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that's what that is about. It's like a diary. It's like where I was coming off a tour, working a lot, but not in a bad way or in a bitter way at all. Just like needed to get stuff off of my chest. And I think it's something, I think, you know, no matter what kind of life you have, I think it's something a lot of people can relate to.
Can't sleep, it's killing me. My dreams are killing me. The TV is killing me.
There's another song that really stands out on this album, and you might have to help me with the pronunciation here. This is the one from a folk song. It's called...
Yeah, it's called Jag vet en del I rosa, and it's a Swedish folk song. Nobody knows who wrote it because it's so old. Jag vet en del I rosa och vit som liljeblad när jag på henne tänker så görs mitt hjärta glad dess stämma ger en hjärtans tröst likt näktergalens blida röst så fager och så ljud. It's a song about losing someone you love. It's very melancholic, but it has like a respect for, you know, where life takes you.
Can you translate a line or two for me?
Yeah, jag vet en del I rosa is the first line. It means I know a beautiful rose.
Hmm.
And it's very old Swedish, but it's like it describes this flower. And then the second verse is about, you know, people losing each other, but then always remembering each other and then maybe finding each other somewhere.
I hågen när du jämt mig när farväl, farväl, min hjärtans kär. Mång tusen godnatt.
Do you ever record your own songs in Swedish?
No, I don't. I do make up, like, silly versions, though, of my songs in Swedish. And it's hard. I mean, singing in Swedish, it's just, I don't know. There's something about writing in English that's nice, because it's not my language. It gives me a little bit of, like, a resistance or, you know, like, a problem that I need to solve all the time. When you know a language really well, it's like you, it's almost like you stop questioning what it is that you're doing.
Robin, it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Björk is easily the world's most famous Icelander. She's probably as well known for her eccentric outfits as she is for her voice. But oh, what a voice. Our colleague Guy Raz, the weekend host of this program, explains why hers is the latest in our series, 50 Great Voices.
Let's get some housekeeping out of the way first. How is your name properly pronounced?
Björk. Okay. Guðmundsdóttir.
Even though most English speakers say Björk, it's not really Björk.
It's Björk.
Björk. Björk.
Yeah. I usually say it rhymes with jerk. You know, someone's a real jerk. And that sort of Björk. Gets
all right.
It.
All right. Yeah. There are people, and I'm not making this up, who do not believe Björk is a human, or at least 100% human. And sometimes, when I hear her voice, I wonder as well. There is something celestial about it, as if it comes from another world, a fantastic and colorful and utopian world.
Attracting the glacier hat, looking hard for a moment of shine.
I think for me it's always been about spatialness.
Spatial as in space, as in the vast environment around her. It's how she thinks about where her voice fits into the sounds she hears. Water, wind, thunder, breaking waves, and volcanic eruptions.
I feel there's something called, like, northern or arctic sound, which is more stark. It just means there are fewer things. Like in Iceland, you have the lava, you have no, almost no trees, almost no animals, and almost no people. So things are very stripped down. It's very naked.
A voice, a distinctive voice, is like an instrument that can't be invented. Think the gravel of Tom Waits or the heartbreaking fragility of Billie Holiday. Björk's voice is also an instrument. It can shout, and it can growl, and it can spew utter gibberish.
clatter, crash, clack, crack, bang,
sound. I like to involve the emotional aspect a lot because there is space in a lot of my melodies to do ad libs if you want. That if one day I'm hoarse or I'm very extremely happy or I'm hyper or whatever, that I can involve that, you know.
Björk was already a star in Iceland at age 11, but it wasn't until 1992 when she broke out as an international superstar with the release of her solo album called Debut.
If you ever get close to a human and you
That record showcased her range and her quirky sensibility. Lyrics about pitch-dark forests and tiny sparks that live within them. Landscapes that evoked a kind of Grimm's fairy tale world.
When I was 13, I had saved enough money, so I bought myself a tent and a rucksack. And I would go and camp and live on my own. I really liked being on my own, so I would sing a lot. And then I probably started hitchhiking when I was about 16 or 17, and then I would go and go further out and walk around in the lava and stuff and sing a lot.
Do you like your voice? Have you always liked your voice?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's probably the part I'm most comfortable with myself. I mean, for me, it's home. It's my home, you know? And maybe that was without being conscious of it. When I was walking outside as a kid and singing, I was kind of like sonically establishing, like being territorial and say, okay, this is my home. And singing quietly when I was next to the lava, and then when I would get up on a hill, the chorus would come and I would sing louder. So I think it's my home.
And sometimes she allows the rest of us inside that home. I'm Guy Raz.
The pleasure is all mine too.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to NPR's Arts Channel. So long.